This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This summer, Volvo announced that starting in 2019, all of its vehicles will either be fully battery-powered or hybrid. It's betting big on the electric future. But no American car manufacturers have followed suit, and as far as American consumers are concerned, we continue to buy SUVs and trucks, and electric cars are way, way, way down on the list. They're also typically not your budget car, and there has yet to be a massive trickle-down into the used car market. So when we hear announcements that the state is offering a rebate on electric vehicles, and the future of Burlington's clean energy plan relies on more people buying electric cars, and the Tesla charging stations start popping up in the parking lots of expensive grocery stores, what does that actually tell us about the future? Are we reaching a turning point? Or is a future where we all plug in our cars at night still mostly a daydream? We're going to talk about it today, and we're joined by Dave Roberts, Drive Electric Vermont Coordinator with the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation. Hi, Dave. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
And by Lisa Altman-Hall, Professor at UVM's Transportation Research Center. Welcome to the show, Professor Altman-Hall.
Thank you, Jane.
All right. So let's just do this big picture, and then we can get into a lot of the details. And we've had a ton of people commenting, even before the show starts, on varying perspectives on this. But where are we in this idea of us all having, you know, the George Jetson electric car, Dave?
Well, we've got a ways to go, but we're making great progress. We're currently, electric vehicles are about 3% of the new vehicle market in Vermont. So there are about 2,000 in the state. It's less than 1% of the registered vehicles. But as we see the range increase and the price come down, we're seeing last quarter was the most EVs registered since we've been tracking about 5 years ago. So definitely seeing some good progress.
When you say good progress and we're getting there, we're, you know, making good, the word good keeps propping up. So clearly the judgment value for you is that electric vehicles are good.
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Well, a couple of reasons. So first, from a climate and environmental perspective, they have drastic reductions in emissions, even when you take into consideration where the electricity is coming from. So it's basically cuts your carbon emissions in half or more. From a budget perspective, Vermonters are spending over $1 billion a year on gasoline and diesel. Switching to electric could cut that in half or more. So, and from a household perspective, folks spend a lot of money on vehicle maintenance as well as energy costs, and electric vehicles are much simpler, so there's less to maintain and a lot of opportunities for savings there as well.
Lisa, what do you think? Where are we, and what's the big picture?
Well, I'm a person that studies, you know, travel behavior. Where do people go? You know, what type of travel does a household do, not just within their home region, but, you know, throughout the country and the globe? And we need to decarbonize the passenger transportation system. And the strategy to do that is multi-pronged. We can reduce the amount we travel. We can have more efficient vehicles. We can change our behavior, things like stopping idling. But the most important thing there is to have lower carbon fuels, and electricity is one of those, and that's especially true in the state of Vermont.
Okay, so that all sounds great, but if we're betting our future on electric vehicles and manufacturers have not fully embraced that idea yet, we're seeing a lot of movement and progress on that, and certainly I think almost every car manufacturer has either a hybrid or now an electric in its fleet somewhere, but we're not seeing a Ford F-150 electric vehicle, which I think is the most popular registration in Vermont, right? And I think there may be an SUV or a couple SUVs that you can get that are hybrids, but we're not seeing this sort of massive flooding of the most popular car types as electric. So if we need to make these changes, but we're not there yet in terms of what consumers can buy, is there a disconnect, Professor Altman-Hall?
I think it's fair to say that the availability of the different types of vehicles that people want to meet their perceived household needs is one of the reasons why we're going just a little bit slower than advocates would have hoped. But the reality is transportation and travel is a highly complex system. And I don't think anybody really projected that we would, you know, flip a switch and change overnight. So it's okay that there's a transition period. I think what's not okay is that there isn't really a lot of widespread public awareness that that's the direction we need to be going, not just as Vermonters and Americans, but globe-wide in terms of passenger transportation.
So where's the disconnect there?
Well, in some ways, I think that in Vermont, we've enjoyed a lot of great programs like Drive Electric Vermont at VEIC and Clean Cities at UVM, and Vermonters tend to be ahead of the curve, but there probably needs to be some widespread private-public partnerships around teaching people about EVs, the different EV options. You know, the fact that a hybrid does still have that internal combustion engine and you're not going to be stranded by the side of the road. And knowing where your electricity comes from, I think, is another important piece of that public education. We need to know what these different types of vehicles are, what type of range goes with them, where our electricity comes from. And then I think we all need to think quite carefully about what our household travel patterns are and maybe start realizing that we're buying a very expensive piece of computerized machinery for that sort of one extreme trip. It might be, you know, 5 or 6 per year.
You mean because the electric vehicle has a battery range, and so you can only go a certain mileage, and people are buying for that trip to grandma's rather than their everyday commute around.
Yeah, so it's not just the range, it's also the size of vehicles that we buy. Most of us drive alone and don't need that large vehicle for our everyday travel.
But Dave Roberts, even if people are educated, I'll use myself, I'm not sure I'm ever going to be able to purchase a new off-the-lot car. And there are not a lot of electric vehicles in the used car market. So even if I wanted to buy an electric vehicle, you know, that either has to be my sole priority and forget about the kids' car seats and, you know, the needs to go to the dump on the weekend, or I'm just not going to be able to buy one, at least not in the very near future. I mean, if that's the deal, a lot of Vermonters are left out of it.
So there's a couple of ways that EVs get more affordable, and certainly in the used market, that's important. That's about 20% of the current growth in Vermont is coming from the used market, because we are starting to see used Nissan Leafs and Chevrolet Volts and other models appearing there. But also leasing is a popular option. You can lease an electric car for as little as about $200 a month. It's a new car, so it's covered by warranty, so you don't have the concerns about maintenance and things like that. The federal tax credit is rolled into the lease typically, so that's one of the ways that the monthly payment gets as low as it does. So some people are really surprised that it can be as affordable as that. You know, there's a range of different EV models out there. There's about 30 available in Vermont, and certainly at the upper end, there are some that are very expensive, but, you know, there are some models that are surprisingly affordable, and particularly when you take into consideration some of the incentives that are available. In addition to the federal tax credit, we have a number of Vermont electric utilities that are offering incentives, and some are specifically geared toward low and moderate income households. So that's a help as well.
Yeah, but that credit that I think you're referring to is like $1,800 off. But if you're a family who's looking to buy a vehicle for $6,000 or $8,000, and you know this idea is that you could get $1,800 off a new vehicle or a $20,000 vehicle, that's still, I mean, you're painting a very rosy picture, but either the perception is off, as Professor Altman Hall was talking about, or there really is still not a huge market for people who, you know, for the wide swath of Vermonters of all different income brackets and needs.
Well, certainly we do need to see the prices continue to come down, and that is happening. Manufacturers and industry people think that EVs will hit parity with gasoline vehicles sometime in the 2020s, maybe around 2025. And so in the meantime, that's why the incentives are helpful. And the more growth that we see sooner, the faster they arrive in the used market, where things really do get much more affordable. And there are used EVs available for under $10,000 today.
Dennis in Burlington says, what's the state of home electric costs in Vermont, and how does this impact electric cars? Lisa?
That's kind of Dave's area, but our electricity in Vermont is a little bit more expensive than the nationwide average. But I believe Dave likes to say that the equivalent is $1.50 a gallon if you're paying for the electricity here in Vermont and using it in your car.
On that idea of electricity and shifting costs, Steph says environmentalists love electric cars. However, they never acknowledge that electric power derived from coal is needed to charge them. Coal is nowhere near clean energy. I hope you'll mention this contradiction and irony in your discussion today. What do you both think about that?
So there's a really great Department of Energy website where my students have had fun playing this fall, where you can put in your state location and see what percentage your electricity comes from renewable and all individual sources. And in Vermont, it's about, I think, 50% now renewable. We're on the cleaner side. And it's sort of part of thinking about how there needs to be a portfolio of change. It can't all happen at once. Yeah.
So that equation, though, you know, when Steph is saying it doesn't work out, she thinks. What do you think? Does it work out better still?
I think in the end, as a society, we have to make it work out better. And I like to use the analogy with my students that, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense that we're all driving around with these teeny weeny little factories in our cars. And they're inefficient. Only about 20% of the energy in that petrol is making it to the energy that turns our wheels. And on top of that, we can't really have effective emission control equipment on every one of those teeny weeny little factories. So it's a lot better to generate your energy efficiently and in a place where you can control the pollutants and to make this transition to an electrified passenger mobility system.
Dave Roberts.
Well, in terms of the coal generation, powering an EV with coal-generated electricity is about the equivalent of a 35-mile-per-gallon gasoline vehicle, which is still better than the Vermont average. But fortunately, we have basically no coal in the Vermont mix, as Lisa was saying. So right now, we're over halfway there in terms of getting to our renewable energy goals, getting up to 75% under the state's renewable energy standard by 2032. So as the grid gets cleaner, driving an EV will get cleaner.
Isha says Vermont is not separate from the rest of the USA, which gets just 7% of its electricity from solar and wind combined. If everyone switched to electric cars, the nation's use of electricity would skyrocket. The better solution is to protect open space so people live closer together and can travel by train or by bicycle or walking. This is how it's done even in rural Europe. You know, I know this is something that you both think about, this idea not only of what our vehicles should be, but can we change our thinking about transportation in general? So, Lisa, what do you think about Isha's note?
I think that's absolutely true. And there's something to be said for the good old-fashioned, you know, transportation and our mobility needs just stem completely from the land use arrangements that we build. And we have the legacy of those for a long, long time. So we want to think carefully about how we build our society and building a society that can have more biking, more walking, and better transit service. And as our population ages, that's going to be more important, too. I get a little concerned when I hear all the hype around driverless cars and what's called the three revolutions right now, sort of sharing of rides, autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles. And there's actually a real sort of fear in that we could create all sorts of congestion with these autonomous vehicles. And there's also a hope that some of our rural transportation needs could be met with those autonomous vehicles, and if they're electrified, that we could have a lot of really great things come from these revolutions. So I absolutely think it's worth thinking about the whole portfolio of how we serve mobility needs for our land use.
Steve and Charlotte emailed in comparing the cost of his Nissan Leaf, an electric vehicle, with a gas-powered car, and he calculates that he saved about $550 a year. And he says, quote, because of their limited range, especially in the winter when battery range drops 20% or more, electric vehicles work best for families who have a commute to work that's within battery range and also have a second car for longer trips. Let's go to Becky, who's calling in from Waterbury. Hi, Becky. Go right ahead.
Hi, I was calling to talk about the feasibility of my Nissan Leaf. I own one as a family car. I did some research before I bought the car and discovered several people online who had successfully fit three car seats or a booster seat and two car seats in the back of a Nissan Leaf. I have two rear-facing convertibles in mine right now, and it's definitely feasible. And there's still trunk space for picking up groceries or, you know, ski equipment or whatever else you might need to get in the back.
So do you like it? You like what you see in terms of cost for you and other reasons that you had to buy the Nissan Leaf?
Oh, absolutely. I love this car. I actually bought it because I had a recalled TDI Volkswagen, and I just feel like I made a huge upgrade to this car. It's much more applicable to my lifestyle, and I wish that I had done it years ago. I've owned it for 7 months now, and I have had one $200 checkup at the dealership, and that has been my only car cost other than my monthly payments.
Becky, thank you very much for sharing your experience. I appreciate it. Dave, that must be music to your ears as the Drive Electric Vermont coordinator.
It certainly is, but I hear that all the time. I mean, electric vehicle owners are typically very satisfied. They're among the most satisfied owners of any type of vehicle out there. And it's because the cars, I mean, we're talking a lot about the environmental and energy benefits, but they're also a lot of fun to drive. So they're just great cars performance-wise as well.
Becky mentioned just one tune-up cost her $200 in the lifespan of the car so far. And you also mentioned that fewer maintenance costs. So where does that come in?
Well, it's particularly with the all-electric cars. And there are two types of electric vehicles, plug-in electric vehicles. There's the all-electric, which are powered solely by battery. And then you have plug-in hybrids, which have both a gasoline engine and a battery. And so when you run low on range after 10 to 50 miles, you can just run on the gasoline as long as you need to. So with the all-electrics in particular, you don't have the internal combustion engine. You don't have exhaust. You don't have oil changes. You just have an electric motor and the battery. So it really simplifies the maintenance. There's just a lot less to go wrong.
Where do things stand now with how far you can drive on one charge?
Well, it depends on the vehicle, right? So with the all-electrics, it's anywhere from about 75 to 300 miles. For the plug-in hybrids, you go 10 to 50 miles on a charge, but then you can run on gasoline as long as you need to. And those are the more popular models in Vermont right now. It's about three quarters of the Vermont market are the plug-in hybrids. And with the all-electrics, there is a growing network of charging stations, both in Vermont and around the country. Tesla is definitely a leader in that. They have what they call their superchargers. You can drive from Vermont to Arizona purely on their fast charging. You just stop for about a half an hour every 200 or 300 miles or so.
So basically, anytime you need to take a pee, you just find a place to do it where there's a charging station.
That's one way to do it, yes.
I'm your new marketing coordinator. I've got it for you. Today, we're talking about electric cars, how they factor into clean energy plans in Vermont, and what a realistic future looks like as far as all of us owning electric cars goes, or maybe most of us. We're talking with Lisa Altman-Hall, professor at UVM's Transportation Research Center, and Dave Roberts, Drive Electric Vermont coordinator with the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation. Ed says, I want to buy electric, but my main issue is, like many people in Vermont, I live on an unpaved road, unpaid driveway, a farm actually. I have yet to see a reasonably priced car that can handle these conditions in winter / mud season. Dave, do you have a car for Ed?
Well, I get this a lot. So there's a couple of different answers. It really depends on just how bad his road is and how much clearance he needs in the vehicle, if he needs all-wheel drive. He's certainly right that there aren't many sort of typical SUV-type electric cars available at an affordable price right now. We do expect to see the Mitsubishi Outlander plug-in hybrid by the end of this year, which will be starting around $35,000, which is much more affordable than the other options that are currently out there. But in the meantime, there are a lot of owners with Nissan Leafs. They have pretty good clearance. If you put winter tires on, most people manage just fine. But it really does depend, you know, if he's got a rough driveway, it could be an issue for him.
Diana in Fairfield says, I own a Prius since 2011, and I want to own a fully electric car and run it from my solar panels. I can't swing the current cost, even with the incentives. And because I drive over 100 miles each day for work, I can't lease a vehicle. My hope is that the prices will come down in the next year or two as more manufacturers commit to EV. And BHA in Vermont says, with the advent of the Tesla Model 3, which you won't be able to get for at least a year and a half unless you're already on, quote, the list, and the Chevy Volt, both with a 230-mile range, more people will be interested in an electric car. Still expensive, to be sure. Hopefully more manufacturers will bring out 200-plus-mile cars in the near future. What about the idea, Lisa, I often remember hearing these discussions about and the environmental impact of buying a new car, even if it's an electric car, versus running your old gas guzzler into the ground and doing that sort of comparison of which has more environmental costs. Because obviously, in terms of running it, the electric vehicle, depending on where you're getting your electricity from, may be cleaner. But there's a lot that goes into making that car, making those batteries, shipping batteries around the world if they're not made in the same country as the chassis. So do you have a sense of where those scales are tipping right now?
Yeah, I've seen people estimate between 2 and 3 years to sort of get of driving to get back that carbon sink of the car being manufactured. And of course, that varies with the type of car.
So it's about 2 or 3 years. But, you know, if you have an old car and you have the funds to buy a new one, are you better off letting your old car?
Well, it depends. I actually have an older minivan right now that I'm considering trading in on an EV. And we have thought about that. Well, this is a sunk cost for us. It's a sunk piece of carbon for us. But on the other hand, it's still a very good vehicle. And maybe, you know, my kids have left the house. Maybe I should be putting that minivan into the used vehicle market and having it used by somebody who would fill it up instead of just the two people in my household, because it's inefficient in that regard.
Right. It's not like it necessarily has to go to this scrap heap just because you get rid of it.
No.
Stuart is calling in from Worcester. Hi, Stuart. Go right ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
So my questions center on winter conditions. I'm wondering, you know, what's the road clearance? What's the clearance, undercarriage clearance for electric cars? I'm thinking in unplowed snow, you're going to need 6 to 8 inches of clearance. Is that possible?
Stuart, yeah, so that's one. You've got a couple other questions about winter driving and EVs?
Yes.
Go for it.
What's the range in cold weather? I'm thinking, you know, temperatures like 10 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit. Is there, you know, can you drive a significant distance in an electric vehicle in colder weather like that? And what's the recharge time in cold weather?
Stuart, thanks for the questions. Dave Roberts?
So the clearance, it really depends on the model. As we were saying a little earlier, the Leaf, which is one of the more popular all-electrics, is around 6 or 7 inches of clearance. So might be a little bit tough if you're driving a lot of unplowed roads. But as I said, if you put winter tires on, that's typically the most important thing to having good winter traction. Other models have more clearance, and certainly at the upper end, there are SUV models that would do just fine just about anywhere.
And battery range in winter and charging time? I mean, I know for, you know, certain things that I try to plug in and charge in the wintertime, it takes a long time, and
sure,
that battery dies quickly.
Yep. So battery range, you typically see about a 20 to, in some cases, as much as 40% reduction, sort of worst-case scenario on a frigid Vermont day. It depends on the model and how the vehicle battery is heated and things like that. But typically, for most people, it's not a big problem. And especially for the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, which can run on gasoline, you will get less battery range, but you still have that gasoline to fall back on, so you don't need to worry about being stranded or anything like that. And there are some tips to making sure that you have as much range as possible. So things like using the heated seats and steering wheels instead of the cabin heat is more efficient. Maybe slowing down a little bit, that'll help give you a little extra boost. Preheating the vehicle while it's still plugged in so you're not running the heat off the battery, things like that.
Could you put one of those blankets like the horses wear over it to keep it a little bit warmer?
It helps to keep it in a garage, but it doesn't have to be there. And they run just fine. They'll start just fine. But you do have to keep in mind that reduced range, especially with the all-electric models. And then in terms of the charging time, so a lot of people just plug into a standard outlet at home. It'll work just fine. You get about 5 miles of range per hour of charging. So most EVs will charge overnight that way. It does take a little bit longer in the cold weather, but not a big deal, typically.
Rob in Montpelier says, I'm an automotive technician and a longtime car guy, and I was a huge anti-electric car person until I actually drove a good one. These cars are so good. They're not slow, they're not boring, and the ranges are only getting better. I could go on forever on this topic. And John is on the line with us from Springfield. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Yes, I was just calling because every time I hear this on the radio, I never get to ask, but me and my dad, we build antique cars, and what's that going to do for fuel prices later on, and are there going to be gas stations if everything goes electric for like the antique car guy that likes to build street rods?
John, thanks for the call. Okay, Lisa, send us out into the future. Is gas going to be more expensive because nobody's using it and all gas stations are going away because we're all driving electric? It's just going to be plug-in stations?
So it's going to be a long transition. I mean, most people are thinking that there's only going to be 15% to 25% of the market even by 2030, and people are concerned about us making actually the climate goals of 2030. So I don't think the gas stations are are going to go away too quickly. And that for a long time, many of us in transportation planning believed that actually the high price of fuel would cause the transitions in transportation and land use that we were hoping for as community planners. And at this time, we don't necessarily see that rise in fuel costs coming. And I don't think this transition is going to be what we would consider disruptive or happen so fast that there isn't time to readjust.
But eventually, you might need to make those antique hot rods, sort of modernize them so that they're EVs.
That there is that possibility, but I don't think it's going to happen in the next decade or two.
Let's go to Jeffrey, who's calling in from Georgia. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Go right ahead.
I've heard a couple of different questions about the buying a new car and making it more versus holding on to your old car. I read an article recently about the cobalt that's mined. I guess it's part of the battery technology in the Tesla cars, and I'm not sure how many other electric vehicles. And the article focused on children in Africa that were 5 to 8 years old that were the miners of this cobalt, and I'm wondering where the battery technology is coming from, and if wealthy Tesla owners are actually basically having little African kids make their batteries.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. I see Dave Roberts, you nodding in acknowledgement that you know the article that he's talking about.
I know of those articles. I'm not sure the specific one, but definitely that's an issue. Cobalt is commonly used in lithium-ion batteries, which are ubiquitous in our technology today, including electric cars and cell phones and computers and all those things that power our modern lives. And so cobalt mining is an area that manufacturers are paying more attention to. Volkswagen, for example, has a big push to do more electric vehicles, and they recently sort of did a procurement process for cobalt, and they're making sure that there are ways to avoid those sorts of mining situations where children and things like that. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that petroleum also has very significant costs of a similar sort. So, ideally, the manufacturers will be continuing to improve that, but it is an area that needs some attention.
Julia is calling in now from Cabot. Hi, Julia. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm one of those bootstrap homesteaders. I've lived off-grid for 6 years now, and I've just learned to do with less in terms of electricity. I don't have one of those nice big banks, you see. I have one solar panel, and it's a 40-watt, which is not much. But it's enough to power my modem and charge my laptop most of the year. Not coming up November, December when it's really dark. But, okay, I can get by with that. I would love to have an EV. I don't see how I can do that. The reason I mean, believe me, I don't hate electricity. The cost was prohibitive to bring it in when I bought my land. And so if I have to bring in electricity, that's kind of defeating the purpose. If I have to run a generator to run the car, well, that seems silly. I may as well just drive a car.
Yeah, Julia, it's interesting you've given this a lot of thought. Lisa, what do you think? I mean, is it just a situation where it's not going to work for everybody?
Yeah, I think it is. I think the interesting thing Julia points out is that we all have to think carefully about the portfolio of energy and the portfolio of imprint we have in our lives. And I would say, as some, a bit of a transportation professor geek, that not enough people have given critical thought to their vehicles and how far they drive in those vehicles and how much they may need that large vehicle. And so I guess what I take away from Julia's call is that she's done some careful thought about where she wants, the resources that she uses in her life to be. And I would encourage people to really think about travel in that same way. We do a lot of surveys at the UVM Transportation Research Center surveying people's travel. And some focus groups a couple of years ago, people were saying, wow, you tracked me for a year. And I had never thought about my travel. And the majority of the people in that survey, 229 of them were Vermonters, they only had about 10 long trips out of town. in a year. And in 2009, we collected daily travel for about 1,926 vehicles in Vermont with the Federal Highway Administration. 90% of the vehicles went under 100 miles a day. And so I would say don't assume that you need a certain level of mobility. Give some careful thought to what mobility you need in a year, the type of careful thought that Julia's given to her electricity.
What do you do, though, if yes, 90% of your travel is in a very small radius, but you do make those 10 trips a year, and you know, if you're have a partner and you can share cars, you know, maybe you can get one that's designed for travel around town and one that's designed for those longer trips. But if you're a single person and you have one car, how do you do that? How do you make that calculation and be the most ethical, practical, forward-looking person you can be?
Well, the truth is about 28% of those long trips by the Vermonters we surveyed were by air anyway, which is a form of mass public transportation. And I would say that we have to start thinking about mobility as a portfolio of services. And we have CarShare Vermont and other forms of ride sharing and public transportation, and you need to think about not having a vehicle that meets all of your needs, but sort of using a portfolio of mobility services is where hopefully some of that is walking and biking, which of course is practically zero energy at all.
We got a note from Amy who wonders how quickly will the development of charging stations match purchases of electric cars. She says, I have a plug-in hybrid and I often find the charging stations in downtown Burlington or at UVM taken. And along similar lines, Nichol in Guilford says, if a driver runs out of charge, for example, way out in the sticks, what are their options for a remote charge? For example, as a driver of a gas-powered car, I could borrow a can of gas at a nearby house or call a friend to bring me a can of gas or, in worst case, walk to the nearest station. But what options does a driver have other than being towed back into town? I suppose you could ask, you know, some random person for a plug for a little while, but what about it?
So it's very rare that people run out of juice, but typically it does require a tow to somewhere where you can plug in. But you can plug into any standard 120-volt outlet and get about 5 miles of range per hour. So you might have to hang out for a while if you're in that situation. There are, not in Vermont yet, but in other states that have higher numbers of electric vehicles, AAA, I think in the Seattle area, has a truck that will come out and give you enough juice to get about 10 to 15 miles. So we expect that type of technology would become available more universally in the coming years.
Let's get one call in here from Spencer in Weybridge. Hi, Spencer. Go ahead. What's your experience?
Well, we have a Leaf, which is absolutely ideal for anything we want to do in the local area. We use it exclusively for that. But if you're going to try to travel long distances, there are two things that really are a different mindset for an electric car driver. One is you have to plan your travel very carefully so that you know where the charging stations are and that they're within range. But the other one is it really takes a different attitude toward time, because you have to build in enough time either at your destination or along the way for the charge. And even if you have a level 3 charger, it takes about 30 minutes to get back up to full charge. So we found that when we go long distances, you have to take secondary roads. That reduces the demand of energy. And just make sure that you have time. You can't be in a hurry.
Spencer, I appreciate you sharing your personal perspective and tips. You know, it's interesting as we talk about moving into this electric future and the pace and perhaps the maybe rosier pace that some had projected than where we're going. If that is the direction we're going, we're all going to have to start thinking about things like what Spencer talks about. So thank you for that. And thanks as well to our guests today. Dave Roberts is Drive Electric Vermont Coordinator with VEIC, the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation. And Lisa Altman-Hall is Professor at UVM's Transportation Research Center. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm.